without knowing the social standing of the various people. And conveying this in grammar means that you can actually tell when you've been accepted as a member of a group. Now, speaking from experience as a foreign student, as long as your professor uses the honorific, you have not been accepted. You are an outsider. And therefore, the first time the professor shifts grammar and moves you down, it's a cause for celebration. The professor has accepted you. You are now like the other native-born students in his class below him as a student. And that means the professor is invested in your success because you're now part of his group. Your success reflects back on him. So if you're in Japan on business, the first time a colleague says, your idea stinks, it is great. Great news, you're an insider. And if that conversation is in Japanese, that change will actually be marked by new verbs with new suffixes and new grammatical forms. And maybe your colleague will switch from san to kun, and that's all part of accepting you, bringing you closer, which now means she can say, your idea stinks. Now, this happens in all cultures. Think of this simple shift from vous to tu in French. And that just means, let's be closer, let's be less formal. But in Japanese, this grammatical shifting is remarkably rich and dense. Social relationships are wired into the language, and shifts in these relationships are conveyed by variations in nouns and verbs and adjectives. In fact, the Japanese language reflects the long-standing Japanese sense that everything will go best if everyone knows their place and everyone follows the rules. But the Japanese also value consensus, and that means it's awkward to explicitly insist on following the rules. In fact, one of the most striking things about daily life in Japan is how rarely anyone explicitly says no. That's just too vulgar. It's too overtly confrontational. And therefore, many aspects of the Japanese language involve seemingly elliptical ways of saying no without ever using an overt negative. Okay, let me give you two examples. One famous and one personal. In 1969, President Nixon and Japanese Prime Minister Sato Eisaku met at the White House. And in conversation, Nixon asked Sato for voluntary Japanese restrictions on textile exports. Cheap Japanese textiles were wiping out jobs in the U.S., and that was hurting Nixon politically. So Sato responded, "Mai muki ni kento shimashou," which literally means, let's examine this with a forward-looking perspective, which is completely evasive, and therefore it meant no. But that nuance was lost in translation, and Nixon came away convinced that Sato was going to restrict textile exports. And when Sato did nothing of the sort, Nixon was furious. Some argue that Nixon later retaliated by neglecting to give Japan any advance notice when Nixon decided to fly to China to meet Mao 2 years later. That snub was retaliation for Sato's lie. Except that Sato didn't lie. He just gave a marvelously conflict-averse Japanese answer, notably a sentence lacking a subject, a sentence that could have meant, I will consider it, or maybe we should consider it. Now, I learned about this incident in college, but I was still unprepared to encounter it myself. Although for me, it just involved bringing an electronic dictionary into an archive, not a major trade agreement. I had my notepad and my pencil bag and a calculator-sized electronic dictionary in my hand, and I went to enter the library, and I was stopped at the sign-in desk with the phrase, "It's the rules of the library, but could you please show restraint in the use of computers?" And that meant, you can't bring in the electronic dictionary. To which I responded in Japanese, "It's not a computer, it's a small pocket dictionary." To which the librarian answered, "The honorable use of electronic dictionaries is currently under discussion." Denchi jishu no goriyou wa soudan ni natte orimasu. Now, I should have known that under discussion meant no. No, no, no. But I took it literally. It's under discussion. Someone was in a room right then, maybe in a back room, discussing whether the regulation against computers applied to little electronic dictionaries. And maybe if I waited 10 minutes, the meeting would be over and they'd let me in. And I was with a Japanese colleague, and he found the entire exchange both amusing and appalling. Now, I don't want to imply that these sorts of elliptical statements are uniquely Japanese. There are plenty of examples in English of polite phrases where the intended meaning is the opposite of the literal meaning. I will take it under consideration in many contexts just means no. But the structure of the Japanese language means that those linguistic moves can be even richer and more subtle, that there are even more ways to say no without saying no, and ways of saying I won't let you do that without ever using the pronouns I or you. And that richness is precious in a society that values consensus.
Lecture 5, Early Japanese Buddhism.
Japanese Buddhism is almost as old as Japanese civilization, or at least as old as written civilization. And that's because some of the same people who brought writing to Japan, early scribes, were also Buddhist monks. Chinese sources suggest that Buddhism was introduced to Japan in the 460 CE, although the more widely accepted date is 552 CE. That's when the king of Baekje sent a mission to Japan, a mission that included monks, nuns, and Buddhist texts. In either case, whether it's the 460s or the 550s or somewhere in between, Japanese Buddhism is about as old as the earliest written records in Japan. So what was Buddhism, and why was it appealing in ancient Japan? Well, by the time Buddhism got to Japan, it was already a millennium old. Buddhism had emerged from Hinduism in North India in roughly the 5th century BCE. The exact historical origins of Buddhism are much murkier than those of Christianity or Islam or Confucianism. But Buddhism spread up into China and then the Korean Peninsula, and by the time it reached Japan, it was a mature religion that had already split into multiple sects. And those sects disagreed on some key points of doctrine. But across all those ancient sects, we can find a few core ideas that were held in common. First, Buddhism assumes reincarnation. You will be reborn after you die, which sounds great. But in Buddhism, this is actually a bad thing, because ordinary lives are full of decay and loss. Here's a quick rundown of why reincarnation stinks. Imagine every possible measure of success. Money, for example. Certainly money is nice, but you can't take it with you. So you spend your life getting rich, and then you lose it all. Okay, what about power? Well, power almost seems to have an air of immortality about it. We remember powerful people after their deaths. Although that's not really true. How many of you can name 10 Egyptian pharaohs? 10 Hittite kings? 10 secretaries of the treasury? These were really powerful people to their contemporaries. And today, even for a highly educated audience, they are forgotten. But what about love? Who could argue against loving and being loved? Well, if you are a deeply loving person, you love your spouse, your kids, your friends, and then you have the pleasure of watching them all get old, get sick, and die. unless you get sick and die first, which is possibly the better option. So Buddhism makes the remarkable observation that reincarnation is actually a trap. Even if you are a deeply moral person, you are stuck in an endless cycle of disappointment and loss. So from a Buddhist perspective, you actually don't want to be reborn. You want to transcend the cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. And that transcendence is called nirvana. So the goal of Buddhism then is to attain nirvana, to stop being reborn, to reach an alternate plane of being that is beyond the vicissitudes of human desire. And those who attain nirvana are known as Buddhas, enlightened beings. In Buddhism, there is more than one Buddha. There is the historical Buddha, known as Gautama Siddhartha, who was born in North India in the 5th century BCE. But there were Buddhas before that, and there will be Buddhas in the future. And they all exist in a plane, in a realm that's beyond our comprehension. Now, if that sounds too ethereal, you are not alone. And in practice, many Buddhists throughout history have been quite content with half steps. So while the ultimate goal might be achieving nirvana, in practice, many people have been quite content with more modest goals, like maybe a few hundred really good reincarnations, maybe richer and more handsome, more powerful each time. And then I'll get around to attaining nirvana and become a Buddha. Many of you probably know St. Augustine's famous prayer, "Grant me chastity and continence, but not yet." Well, many Buddhists think the same about nirvana. And, as we'll see, Buddhism has room for those more modest expectations. So what do you do, as a Buddhist, to move along spiritually? First, towards a better rebirth, and then, ultimately, towards nirvana. Well, for a better rebirth, the rules are unremarkable. Don't lie, don't steal, don't cheat, don't murder, don't be mean to other people or other living things. Give money to Buddhist temples. No big surprises there. What's more intriguing is how Buddhism treats the higher stages of wisdom, the path from being a good ordinary person to a truly enlightened being. One of the central tenets of Buddhism is that desire leads us astray and makes us crazy. We all want money and power and love, and we all secretly dread losing those things. And we all secretly know we are going to lose them when we die. So at some level, we all know that we are rushing around doing pointless things. And in Buddhism, inner peace comes from accepting the transience of everything, accepting that we will lose everything, and therefore not trying to hold on. But Buddhism goes further. If everything is transient, and desire leads you to ignore that, then desire blinds you to reality. It's not just that desire makes you do stupid things, it stops you from perceiving reality. What our senses tell us about the world, what we think is real, well, that's actually just a mix of our hopes and fears. The real world is actually something completely different. Some of this thinking appears secondhand in the Star Wars movies. George Lucas, the creator of Star Wars, calls himself a Buddhist Methodist, and he made the Jedi Knights a bit like Buddhist monks. So remember when Luke has crashed his X-Wing in a swamp, and Yoda teaches Luke that with a clear mind you can lift a spaceship out of the swamp? And Luke doesn't believe his eyes. And Yoda says, "That's your problem, believing your eyes. Instead, you need to use the Force." Well, that last part, use the force, is just a Star Wars version of what Buddhists would call the power of a clear mind. But both for Buddhist monks and Jedi Knights, our senses are a bad guide to reality. We need Buddhist insight to know what's really real. And many things that seem logical at first are just symptoms of an unenlightened, distracted mind. Which brings us to an important question. How do you get that wonderfully clear mind? How do you attain enlightenment and become a Buddha? Well, in ancient Japan, that path to Buddhist wisdom was overwhelmingly associated with monastic life, monasteries and abbeys. Monks and nuns separated themselves from worldly desire. They ate a Spartan diet. They avoided animal products in order to avoid killing other sentient beings. They abstained from sex, alcohol, and most worldly temptations. They also meditated and studied sutras, transcriptions of lectures by wise monks and by Gautama Siddhartha. Now, as I've noted, Buddhism arrived in Japan sometime around the 6th century. And for the next 3 centuries, it was actively promoted by Japanese rulers. But why did rulers find this essentially monastic tradition so appealing? Why did they promote it? Well, first, promoting Buddhism was just part of what civilized kings did in East Asia. They did it in the Tang Dynasty, they did it in Tang China, and in Korea, and Japanese monarchs followed suit. So as part of the Ritsuryo state, the imperial court ordered the construction of monasteries and abbeys, and the printing of Buddhist texts. But in addition to just looking civilized, ancient Japanese monarchs hoped that the promotion of Buddhism would win them divine protection. Remember, what seems obvious to the unenlightened mind is actually an illusion. And what seems impossible to the unenlightened mind is actually easy for someone approaching Buddhahood. And at the risk of invoking Star Wars again, things that seem like magic to the pedestrian mind, well, that's just what Jedi do. They make things fly around with their minds. So for ancient Japanese rulers, promoting Buddhism, supporting Buddhist clergy, could seem like almost magical protection. This idea is explicit in texts like the Sutra of the Golden Light. According to that text, the Buddha was delivering an explanation of the path to enlightenment. And when he finished, 4 great kings who were listening took a vow. They pledged that if any future king propagated and studied this Buddhist teaching, they would give him assistance by freeing his land from pestilence, by giving him and his subjects longevity, by making his soldiers strong, and by bringing harmony to his lands. And then the Buddha responded by saying, "Wonderful. And in addition to your vows of protection, studying this sutra and disseminating it will also help the king by making his ministers work together in harmony, making his officials generous rather than covetous, and winning respect for his government." So this sutra guarantees good things in 2 ways. The first is quasi-magical. Heavenly kings will protect you. The second is a result of sutra study. It makes the government ministers moral, honest, and compassionate, and that leads to better government. Now, as a Japanese king in the 600s and 700s, you'd probably take one or the other or both, but those rulers seem to have been more impressed by the former, divine protection. For example, one of the oldest temples in Japan, Yakushiji, was founded in Nara around 680, after Empress Jito had fallen ill. Emperor Temmu prayed for her recovery, and he took a Buddhist vow, and he founded Yakushiji Temple with 100 monks, and then, of course, Empress Jito recovered. And in a similar spirit, Emperor Shomu, who commissioned the Great Temple of Todaiji, in the mid-700s, he ordered the construction of a temple in each provincial capital in order to stop a series of crop failures and plagues. And according to the imperial proclamation, Emperor Shomu ordered that, quote, every province should erect one golden image of the Buddha 16 feet in height and write out one copy of the Sutra of Perfect Wisdom. Well, what was the result of these imperial orders? Well, remarkably, because Shomu promoted Buddhism in this way, quote, the wind and rain were orderly, and the five crops grew abundantly. In fact, since the Buddha statues worked so well, Shomu then ordered that each province erect a 7-story pagoda and write out a copy of the Sutra of Golden Light and the Lotus Sutra. Certainly that would bring continued prosperity to Japan. So we can make three key observations about the earliest forms of Buddhism in Japan. First, it was essentially a monastic rather than a popular religious movement. Second, its spread was catalyzed by direct support from Japanese rulers. And third, it was attractive to these rulers largely because of its presumed power to protect and sustain the state. Now, this ancient state-supported Buddhism was important in legitimizing the ancient state, and it was certainly crucial for spreading Buddhism across Japan. But it had its weaknesses. For example, because they were overwhelmingly dependent on state support, many of the temples supported by the imperial court in Nara simply disappeared when the court moved to Kyoto. And even more important, early Buddhism in Japan offered remarkably little for the laity to do, except provide for the monks and be protected by their prayers. So it's not surprising that two new forms of Buddhism began to emerge in the 9th and 10th centuries. Shingon Buddhism, an esoteric form of Buddhism, and then a more popular form known as Pure Land Buddhism. Now, these two schools are very different from each other, but they are even more different from earlier state-sponsored Buddhism, because they were both concerned with engaging the laity, both focused on having people do things to help themselves. Instead of focusing on royalty, who could protect Japan by building temples, these new forms focused on what ordinary people could do to have a more auspicious rebirth. And, unlike the earliest forms of state-sponsored Buddhism, both Shingon and Pure Land Buddhism are very much alive in Japan today. So, let's consider Shingon first. Shingon was founded by the monk Kukai, who's often considered Japan's first important Buddhist writer. Kukai traveled to China in the early 800s as part of a government-sponsored mission. He studied there and was deeply impressed by esoteric Buddhism. The esoteric sects emphasized that advanced teachings needed to be kept secret from everyone except advanced students. Certainly there were ceremonies and services that anyone could observe, but many deeper truths required extensive prior training and initiations. You can't just skip ahead to lesson 14. In that way, Kukai's Shingon school is similar to Tibetan Buddhism. And at the core of Shingon thought is the idea that Buddhist truth is difficult to apprehend. Kukai argued that words alone simply cannot capture Buddhist insight. So he took what I would call a multimedia approach. Shingon Buddhism relies on three tools: mudras, mantras, and mandalas. Mudras, called inge in Japanese, are symbolic hand gestures. These are often depicted in Buddhist art, and these gestures are associated with various virtues. For example, a basic mudra is the gesture of hands resting in each other with thumbs touching. This symbolizes a correct attitude and a deep state of meditation. By contrast, the gesture of the right palm up and the left palm down symbolizes an absence of fear. There is a legend that the Buddha stopped a rampaging elephant with this gesture. So mudras are almost a Buddhist sign language. If you look at a Buddhist statue, the position of the hands is actually a link to the Buddhist liturgy. But for Shingon, in addition, it's useful to think of mudras as a physical way of expressing ideas. Remember that some Buddhist truths are said to be so sublime, so powerful, that they're effectively beyond words. So we can only apprehend them through physical sensation, or through the physical representation of the mudras. After mudras, the second tool in Shingon Buddhism is the use of mantras. In fact, the Japanese word for mantra is Shingon, which in English means true word. It's the name of the sect. A mantra is a word or phrase that has a metaphysical connection to Buddhist truth. So while conscious language, with grammar rules and dictionaries, is of only limited use in attaining enlightenment, Kukai taught that one could use this secret true language, the ultimate language of the cosmos, to move towards truth. So it doesn't matter if you understand a mantra in Shingon Buddhism. If you chant it or hear it chanted, part of your understanding, your enlightenment, will be just the non-interpretive experience of the words. Then you might have it explained and then chant it. And again, this is an esoteric tradition. The truth unfolds in stages. The third tool Kukai introduced was the use of mandalas. Mandalas are extremely detailed paintings, or sometimes groups of sculptures, showing the relationship of hundreds of Buddhas and sages. And in Shingon meditative practice, the goal is to hold this totality in one's mind. For example, one of the most revered mandalas in the Shingon tradition is the so-called womb mandala. And it's incredibly rich and detailed, with literally dozens of different manifestations of the Buddha and Buddhist sages. Just the center of the mandala has 9 different aspects of the Buddha. In the middle is Dainichi, the most ethereal and intangible of all the Buddhas. Dainichi is the Buddha of all places and all times, the Buddha of the past, the present, and the future. Dainichi actually means great sun, and he was therefore associated with Amaterasu, the sun goddess. That's one great example of how Buddhism and Shintoism coexisted for centuries. Now, in the mandala, just below Dainichi is Amida, the Buddha of the past. As we'll see in a moment, there emerged an entire sect of Buddhism devoted to Amida. Now, below Dainichi's right knee is Kanon. Kanon almost became a Buddha, but he heard the suffering of less enlightened humans, and so he stopped just short of full Buddhahood. And so he's in a special space. He's almost a Buddha, but he's also attuned to human suffering, because he didn't fully achieve nirvana, and therefore didn't fully leave our human level of existence. Now, if all of this sounds impossibly complex and abstract, well, guess what? That's kind of the point. Shingon Buddhism revels in that complexity. If it were easy to explain, it wouldn't be Shingon Buddhism. But imagine that your meditation practice involves trying to keep an image this complex and rich in your mind, not just all of these Buddhas, but all the details of the robes of each Buddha, the mudras of each Buddha. So clearly, Shingon Buddhism is strikingly different from Zen. In Zen, the goal is to clear your mind to think about nothing. In Shingon, you push out the distractions of the secular world by putting in complex images of the celestial world. Now, because Shingon Buddhism was so abstract, so demanding, it still assumed that only monks could fully master these abstract insights and move to higher levels of enlightenment. But this vision of deep and profound truths was compelling enough that Shingon was able to survive without state support. Wealthy patrons agreed to support Shingon, and in return they could watch Shingon ceremonies. And if you ever get the chance to observe a Shingon Goma fire ritual, do so. The chanting and the huge flames have a trance-inducing power. It's compelling even if you don't understand a word of the chanting, which again is part of the point of Shingon. We need to add mystical experiences to our basic sense of reason. And Shingon patrons could also be buried in Shingon cemeteries, and that ensured a more auspicious rebirth. And as a result, the Shingon Spiritual Center at Mount Koya, Koya-san, is a truly remarkable place. First, it's beautiful. It's a forested mountain temple complex with huge ancient trees. But it's also a microcosm of Japanese history, because the Shingon graveyard is a sort of who's who of Japanese history. Starting in the 800s and continuing to the present day, there are grave sites for some of the most powerful and storied families in Japanese history, including imperial courtiers and great warlords, and then modern institutional grave sites, like the corporate memorial sites for the Nissan Motor Corporation and the Japan Professional Photographers Society. That one is easy to spot. There are photos etched in the granite. So while the ideas of Shingon Buddhism are indeed incredibly abstract, powerful patrons have wanted to be a part of that tradition for over 1,000 years. But now, I want to draw a striking contrast with Shingon, the most ethereal of Japanese Buddhist traditions, because the Heian period also saw the birth of one of the most accessible forms of Buddhism, Pure Land. Pure Land Buddhism was popularized in Japan in the late 900s by a monk named Genshin. And Genshin's message was simple. The wicked go to hell. And there they are brutally tortured in ways that relate to their iniquities on earth. For example, if you killed someone in your human life, then in hell you would be ripped apart by swords. If you killed something and cooked it and ate it, then you would be boiled in a vat for eternity. Genshin's account of these horrific torments was extremely popular in the Heian period, and there were illustrated versions called Hell Scrolls that graphically illustrated the torments he described. So, like the great Italian poet Dante, Genshin created visions of hell that would inspire art for centuries. But Genshin's vision of hell was balanced by his understanding of salvation. According to Genshin, Amida, that Buddha just below Dainichi in the mandala, that Buddha was ready to save you from hell. According to Genshin, Amida had once taken a vow, back in the ancient past when he was only a monk, and he vowed that as part of his own path to Buddhist enlightenment, he would ease the suffering of any human to call out to him for help. He promised to take those people to a special paradise, the Pure Land. And then he did indeed achieve enlightenment. And so, of course, he kept his vow. So you can avoid going to hell by calling out to Amida. And that emphasis on salvation made Amida Buddhism, or Pure Land Buddhism, a great complement for other forms of Buddhism, like Shingon. If you're on your deathbed, regretting a life of sin and dissipation. Shingon is probably cold comfort. You could commission some prayers, but it's a little bit late to start meditating on a complex mandala. But Pure Land Buddhism was almost custom-made for deathbed regrets. There are even special paintings showing Amida descending from the clouds to rescue a repentant sinner. Some of these paintings even had strings, and you could hold the string and look at Amida in the painting. It was as though the string would guide Amida to you. And some great Heian nobles are said to have died holding strings attached to pictures of Amida. Now, we will come back to Pure Land Buddhism because it became a powerful force in Japanese history. In fact, today, the Pure Land sects are the most popular form of Buddhism in Japan. But I want to leave you today with a sense of the tremendous diversity of Buddhist teachings. First were the state-sponsored forms of early Buddhism in Japan. They were critical in building the ancient imperial state, although today they have virtually no popular following. And by contrast, both Shingon and Pure Land continue to address the spiritual needs of Japanese Buddhists to the present day. And this is true despite the fact that they offer remarkably different perspectives on Buddhist teaching. Each of them has a distinctive influence on Japanese culture, and together they have coexisted for over 1,000 years without insisting on an exclusive claim to Buddhist truth.
Lecture 6, Heian Court Culture.
One of the framing ideas of this course is the notion of cycles in Japanese history, periods of great cosmopolitanism, globalization, and then periods of relative isolation and seclusion. So today, I want to talk about Japan's first period of relative isolation, beginning in the 800s and into the 1300s, and how that shaped Japanese culture and politics. By standard chronology, this 500-year stretch spans two historical epochs, the Heian period from 794 CE to 1185, and then the Kamakura period from 1185 to 1333. Both of those period names are place names. Heian is another word for Kyoto, and Kamakura is a city near present-day Tokyo. Now today, we're going to focus on the Heian period, and in particular, I want to highlight two key issues. One is the relative decline of the powerful centralized state that was constructed in the 700s. And second is the rise of a new political and cultural system, the Heian court, which replaced the centralized state. This court was comprised of a relatively small and tight-knit nobility centered around the emperor, but it was distinct from the powerful administrative system set up in the 700s. Now, as we've seen, the incentive to build a powerful Japanese state was connected to broader international trends, the rise of powerful centralized states on the continent. But if you look at the most important of these states, China, in the 800s, what do you find? Well, basically, you find that the Tang Dynasty is in serious decline. There's a major rebellion around 860, and then from 860 to 960, China is ruled by local strongmen. There's no single Chinese dynasty. And after the end of the Tang Dynasty, the next large dynasty, the Song, which reigned from the 900s to the 1200s, well, the Song is known for its remarkable literary and philosophical achievements, but it controlled much less territory than the Tang. And the Song was always struggling against other empires, the Jurchen and the Mongols, for example. So, a key point is that after 800 or so, China is just not a threat to Japan. And for Japan, contemporary Chinese civilization lost some of its appeal. Japanese scholars during the Heian period, they continued to revere classical Chinese civilization, ancient China, but they grew less and less interested in their Chinese contemporaries. So beginning in the 800s, we begin to see a disengagement from the continent. Not only isn't China a geopolitical threat, it's no longer seen as worth the trip. And that's especially because with the decline of the Tang, the trip to China becomes dangerous. A Japanese mission to China might be greeted by bandits or pirates or mercenaries instead of representatives of the Chinese imperial court. One good measure of this disengagement is the end of official imperial embassies to China. Now, between 630 and 781, Japan sent 15 official embassies to the Tang. So, a major mission about every 10 years. And by contrast, in the 800s, there were only two. And the 894 mission was canceled because the leader of the scheduled mission, Sugawara no Michizane, realized that his political enemies had promoted him to ambassador to China to get him out of town. Maybe they were even thinking he'd get killed on the way. So, by the late 800s, being named ambassador to China is seen more as a ruse or even a punishment, rather than an honor or a privilege. And that canceled 894 embassy. That's the end to official contacts between the Chinese and Japanese imperial courts for centuries. Contacts between Japan and China continued, but they were not led by the imperial court. Instead, they were led by monks or by warriors or pirates, but not the imperial state. So what happens during this period of disengagement? Well, one extremely important result is the gradual transformation of the Ritsuryo state. That highly structured, highly centralized administrative system introduced in the 700s. Now, the Ritsuryo system was always difficult to run. The tax burden was so heavy, so onerous, it caused farmers to desert their fields. And another major burden on the people was conscription, compulsory military service, and forced labor. And for the imperial government, the value of that forced labor began to drop. Remember, a large infantry was useful for seizing territory and holding it against invaders. But the imperial state stopped expanding after the 800s. It pushed the northern frontier up to northern Honshu and took control of all of Kyushu, and then it stopped. So when it came to supporting the centralized army or the centralized system of taxation or that complex system of land distribution, all of which were hallmarks of the Ritsuryo system, the incentive to maintain any of those decreased markedly in the 9th century. And in that context, the imperial court gradually ceded control of those functions to powerful regional figures. Now, because of the absence of written records, we have a very limited understanding of what was actually going on at the village level in the Heian period. But we do know that provincial governors were gradually turned into tax farmers. The central government in Kyoto really stopped caring how they collected taxes so long as they met their quotas. And if they missed their quotas, they had to stay in the countryside. Because for the refined courtiers in the capital of Kyoto, being a deputy provincial governor wasn't an honor, it was more of a punishment because you had to be in the provinces. And at the same time, there were systematic attempts to get land off the tax rolls. Now, recall that temples and shrines had religious tax exemptions, as they do in our society. And certain noble land had tax immunity. But what we find in the Heian period is the steady expansion of these immunities. For example, maybe you once had a fixed term exemption from certain tax payments. Perhaps it was an incentive to develop new farmland. But you file a legal claim arguing that you're actually immune from all taxes forever. And you're even immune from government land surveys. And court politics in the Heian period became increasingly about cutting these sorts of deals to get tax immunities. So here's a modern analogy. Many of you probably make a tax-deductible contribution to a university or maybe a religious charity. But imagine if someone from that church or university suggested that you put all of your assets in the name of the tax-exempt institution, everything. So from now on, everything is tax exempt. You don't owe any income tax, real estate tax, nothing. Now, that would be extremely generous if you were actually giving away all your assets. But suppose the deal was that you kept control over your land and much of the income, and that instead of paying taxes, suppose now you paid a tithing fee to the church or the university, and that fee was significantly less than your earlier tax bill. Well, in Heian, Japan, temples and shrines and high-ranking officials could offer just such deals to landowners. And the high-ranking officials could use their influence in the capital to make sure that no one audited the books. So what was the result of all this deal-making? Well, over the course of a few centuries, a small number of tax exemptions swelled to include more than half the land in Japan. These tax-exempt estates were called sho, or shoen. And historians sometimes like to talk about the shoen system. Now, sho are sometimes described as feudal holdings, which is fine as a sort of shorthand, but I prefer my analogy of farming out tax exemptions. And the key thing to remember is that during the Heian period, the growth of the shoen undermined the power of the central government to tax and redistribute land. Now, what about the military? Well, beginning as early as the 700s, the government began authorizing local commanders to raise their own forces. And in 792, Emperor Kamu scrapped the large conscript army entirely. The government did maintain a police force for the capital, but beyond that, the Heian government allowed and even encouraged the growth of private armies. Provincial governors started to develop their own armies to maintain order and to collect taxes. And all those tax-exempt estates, they began to develop their own security forces. Well, you can see how this might not end well, but because Japan is at peace internationally, the Heian court felt secure even as it was losing control of the countryside. So long as the revenue kept flowing into the capital, they really didn't care. And this era, in which the Kyoto court gradually lost control of the countryside, it's ironically the high point of Japanese classical culture. Now, I know that sounds absurd, but think of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, the French court at Versailles. They were blissfully ignorant of the realities of rural France, and their lifestyles weren't sustainable. But if you were inside that charmed circle, I'd imagine it was glorious while it lasted. So let's look at the court in Kyoto, and let's look at how it worked and who were the powerful figures. Most important was the Fujiwara family. The Fujiwara were originally known as the Nakatomi. They were a powerful ancient clan that began enjoying special imperial favor after 645 when they helped overthrow the Suga. The Fujiwara rose to power by marrying into the imperial line. They did not directly challenge the imperial line. In fact, they honored the tradition that emperors be sons or grandsons of emperors. But through marriage politics, they ensured that emperors married Fujiwara women. And that meant that emperors were routinely surrounded by Fujiwara men. For centuries, emperors were raised with Fujiwara uncles and Fujiwara grandfathers, and those uncles and grandfathers routinely served as the emperor's regents. Gradually, the position of regent became as important as the position of emperor. The best single example of this process is the case of Fujiwara no Michinaga, who lived from 966 to 1028. Through his marriage connections, he was the uncle of two emperors, the grandfather of three emperors, the father of four empresses, and regent for his grandson, Emperor Goichijo. Now, Fujiwara no Michinaga did also have titles in the ancient ritsuryo system, the official civil bureaucracy. But it was his position as the head of the Fujiwara house and his roles as grandfather and uncle to five emperors that gave him real power. His position as Dajō Daijin, prime minister, sometimes translated grand minister of state, that was almost an afterthought. Now, during the Heian period, the aristocracy that comprised the court in Kyoto, it was a small, tight-knit group. At the apex, there were about 20 noble houses, and the extended nobility might have numbered 20,000 people. And since Japan in the 900s had a population of about 5 million, well, this was a tiny fraction of the population. And of course, in such a political environment, marriage politics became extremely important, and courtly behavior was extremely important as well. Now, national politics centered around intrigue amongst 20 elite families, so it became extremely important to know who is having a scandalous affair, who is having a discreet affair, and refinement was essential. Classical or Heian-era standards of elegance included a striking level of cultivation. It included the ability to compose impromptu poetry that reflected the season, the weather, the occasion, and writing poems in response to other poems, basically flirting and bantering through poetry. Those were essential social skills. Now, this emphasis on family politics and court culture had an important gender component, because the Fujiwara didn't displace the imperial line. They married into it. Men got power through their daughters' husbands and their daughters' children. Now, this didn't produce anything resembling gender equality, but it did make for very different marriage patterns, especially as compared to later samurai families. It was common in the Heian period for a nobleman to get married and keep his own residence and visit his wife at his father-in-law's residence. Or the couple might get an independent residence together. Now contrast that with the living pattern that became common under the samurai. Under the samurai, a woman left her father and mother and went to live with her husband's family. That pattern was incredibly rare in the Heian period. In fact, if a Heian patriarch was trying to rule through his grandchildren and nephews, well, then he wanted to bring his son-in-law into his house as much as possible, both physically and politically. The Heian period also produced a surge in women's fiction. In fact, many of the classics of Japanese literature were produced in this period by women. Now, why might that be? Why did Heian court culture nurture women's literature? First, remember the turn away from continental culture, classical Chinese culture. Now, while classical Chinese language remained the language of serious philosophy and political arguments, and classical Chinese into the modern era was considered the realm of men and inappropriate for women, Heian court poetry, by contrast, was composed in Japanese, and poetry was considered appropriate for women. In fact, composing court poetry was considered part of courtly elegance. In the 900s, the imperial court began to emphasize the importance of Japanese poetry by compiling anthologies of great poems. So vernacular poetry in Japanese was celebrated at the highest levels of society. Now, many of the poems in these imperial anthologies are about the beauty of the seasons, about love and longing, about parted lovers waiting for each other. And while men maintained a monopoly on some topics, such as writing about valor in classical Chinese, in the Heian period, we see an entire area of literature in which women's voices were welcomed. One of the great works written in this period by a woman is Genji Monogatari, or The Tale of Genji. So let me tie Heian politics and Heian culture together with a discussion of this masterpiece. The Tale of Genji was composed in the early years of the 11th century. It was written by Murasaki Shikibu. That's a pen name. And we're not sure of her real name. She was born around 978, and she lived to either 1014 or 1025. She was probably the daughter of a mid-ranking Fujiwara noble. Evidently, she rose to be a lady-in-waiting to an empress. Now, the Tale of Genji is a closely observed story, and the main character Genji is inspired by, but not directly modeled after, Fujiwara no Michinaga. Genji is sometimes called Japan's first novel, But I think that's misleading, because the plot and the characters of Genji Monogatari don't resemble a modern novel. There's a narrative arc to the story, but the vignettes, the individual chapters, are often better enjoyed on their own than as part of a massive work. The Tale of Genji is over 1,000 pages in most English translations. Now, the hero of the story is a character known as Hikaru Genji. He is the son of an emperor, Kiritsubo, by that emperor's favorite mistress, known as Lady Kiritsubo. And while the emperor adores his son Genji, he knows that Genji cannot succeed at the highest levels of court because he does not have a powerful sponsor on his mother's side. So he removes him from the direct imperial line, and then he's still a noble, but Genji will no longer be a contender for the throne. Then Genji's mother, Lady Kiritsubo, dies, and when the emperor later takes a wife, the wife looks just like her, and Genji develops a kind of Oedipal crush on his stepmother. Now, Genji himself is impossibly gorgeous. The text explains that it is impossible to look at him without pleasure, and he can have almost any woman he wants, which means that primarily he wants the women he can't have. And that's worth a side note, because for centuries, Genji's story was taken as a sort of morality play, or even a Buddhist parable, because Genji's troubles reflect a Buddhist understanding of desire. Since Genji can have almost anything he wants what he can't get. And then when he gets what he wants, he finds he doesn't want it anymore. And in Buddhism, the idea is you cannot quench desire. You have to transcend desire. Now, from a modern perspective, some of Genji's romantic exploits would be described as date rape. Women in the text look at him adoringly, and that's all he needs to just carry them off. And many of Genji's exploits are scandalous. He actually has an affair with his own stepmother. And then their son becomes emperor. And although they must keep this relationship a secret, the emperor eventually learns that Genji is not his stepbrother, but actually his father. Genji also gets a hold of a young girl who reminds him of his stepmother, and therefore also his mother. And he raises this girl to be his perfect wife. This is sort of a cross between Lolita and My Fair Lady with a bit of Oedipus thrown in. At any rate, when this girl is old enough, Genji marries her. But of course, she dies tragically. So again, there are clear Buddhist overtones to this story. In fact, whenever Genji seems to have a moment of true love, his lover dies. Or conversely, only when they die does Genji realize that he loved them. So there's certainly plenty of the desire leads to ruin theme here. Okay, Genji has lots of women and he's handsome. And even when his son, the emperor, learns that Genji is his father and not his stepbrother, instead of becoming furious, the emperor promotes Genji to high court rank. And even then, Genji is still not happy. Now, I must admit, I'm not a big fan of the plot of the Tale of Genji. Instead, I find the true pleasure of Genji Monogatari is in the small details, the romantic banter. That's the aspect of the story that remains compelling for me today, over a millennium later and across a huge cultural divide. Let me give you a sense of this with a fragment of the fourth of the 54 chapters. It's called Yugao in Japanese, Evening Faces or Twilight Beauty in English. In this episode, Genji is 17, and he is already married. It's an arranged marriage to the daughter of a powerful minister. And Genji already has a mistress, Lady Rokujo. And now he's working on a third liaison with a woman known as Yugao. Now, as you might gather from this backstory, marital fidelity was not highly valued in Heian society. And while men were certainly allowed more latitude than women, Heian society was just not that worried about monogamy. In fact, because women kept their property in a marriage, divorce was rather informal. Couples just drifted apart, Then they connected with new partners, often without a formal divorce proceeding. But Genji